associated with restless behavior and what is known as novelty seeking, the kind of people who are reckless or adventurous in need of something new. Perhaps this is why Q and I took off into a whiteout, or why any of us were here in the first place. We are the tiny maggots you find around the edge of the petri dish. In a book of short stories he wrote about mountaineering, Stevenson called the urge to summit a trance-like mystification, feeling privy to some large but unintelligible secret. When I asked McInerney why he was here, he said, "When the hell else am I going to do something like this?" He told me that when his colleagues stand around the water cooler back in D.C. talking about their vacations, they can scarcely conceive of what he does. He added, "I barely understand it myself." A genetic study of more than 2,000 prehistoric individuals worldwide, ranging between 1,000 to 30,000 years old, found that this pronounced D4 marker is more prevalent among those who migrated as compared to those who maintained a long genetic history in one place. Among Native American genomes and those of their ancestors, the presence of D4 is correlated with an individual's distance from the land bridge. North America, with the closest access to the land bridge, shows 32% of samples with D4 elongation. Central America comes in ahead with 42%, and South America reaches an average 69%, as if people needed that much more oomph to reach that far south. Too high in D4, though, you'd never be seen again, a seed blown beyond all horizons. The Harding is a tricky spot to get through. Compasses are unreliable. A mineral anomaly in the rock buried hundreds of feet below taps the needle off course enough to cause problems. If you hope to use your innate sense of direction, you'd have to surrender out here. Some living organisms use what is called magnetoreception, a sense that enables birds, lizards, and insects to know what direction they are heading. Crystals of the mineral magnetite have been found in human brain tissue, orienting to cardinal directions. Our brains are compasses. Whether or not we use them, or even aware of them, is a personal issue. But on this ice field, using the body as a compass would be useless. In the blind of snow and cloud, we were relegated finally to talking to satellites. Tents vanish from sight after 40 feet, voices taking longer, the mumble of conversations fading after 100. But who was counting? I paid attention to the strokes of skis and poles, feeling as if we'd fallen into space. Snow picked up in the wind, grains hissed across each other. Instead of skiing single file, Q and I traveled side by side, our senses flung wide like a net. My eyes panned, strained, any block of ice sticking up, any rise or fall, nothing. The air cooled, snow came on harder, crystals turned from woolly bars to cold six-pointed flakes near the edge of our petri dish. Q stopped to look back. I stopped too. Our tracks vanished in the gray blowing murk. "I think we're hooking left," he said through the wind. I said, "I thought we were hooking right." It had been an hour. I pulled the GPS out of Q's pack and handed it to him. Holding it in the air, waving at satellites, he punched buttons until the device picked up enough signal to pinpoint a location. We'd come about a mile from camp and were 90 degrees off course, heading up a gradual incline that would lead into a field of mountains, not a place one should go in a storm. He punched in our route home. A mile later, our tents emerged from the emptiness. They looked like lifeboats coming out of the fog, bright and strange to see. The human brain in the late Pleistocene was 5% larger than our modern brains. What we have lost since then is hard, if not impossible, to tell. Only the decrease in volume is evident, not what is missing. Before you think of Pleistocene people as potentially smarter than us, remember that volume does not necessarily translate to function. Domestic animals have smaller brains than their wild counterparts, a result of atrophied aggression, not necessarily reduced intelligence. This is what allows them to live in tighter quarters without ripping each other to shreds. More compact regions of the brain develop to address fealty to unseen forces, a bond between individuals taking up less space than the need to kill one another. More information may have been coming in during the Ice Age, a constant flow from the outside world. Earth, wind, sky, valley, mountain, beast. Neuroscientist John Allman wrote, "Brains exist because the distribution of resources necessary for survival and the hazards that threaten survival vary in space and time." He sees little need for a nervous system if the organism lived in regular and predictable surroundings. It is the complexity of the world that makes us what we are. Brains, Allman continued, are buffers against environmental variability. A bigger brain might be a bigger buffer. Environmental variability, for a Paleolithic human, would have been significantly greater than for most of us living at around 72 degrees Fahrenheit with smooth floors and ergonomic chairs, or any chairs for that matter. The angular gyrus is a region located in the back of the head, key in semantic processing, reading and comprehending words, numbers, retrieval memory, spatial cognition, reasoning, and social cognition. This is probably where a lot of our mass went. Not much larger than a couple grapes, the angular gyrus may have replaced the Paleolithic 5%. People who came to the land bridge were making ornaments of shell, bone, and teeth. Human figurines 20,000 years old in Siberia were carved from mammoth ivory, showing hoods, bracelets, shoes, bags, and gear on their backs. Skin and pole huts were erected and held down by rings of mammoth bones or caribou antlers. People came with languages, the complexity of their speech near or equal to ours. Cooperative hunting would have required communication between hunters and their domesticated wolf dogs, where multiple juvenile and adult female mammoths have been found butchered side by side. This would have required communication, a game plan. Language doesn't fossilize, but it does appear with a host of artifacts, musical instruments, depictive artwork, and the spread of exacting tools and weapon technologies. The late Soviet cognitive scientist Lev Vygotsky wrote that these very human expressions extend the operation of memory beyond the biological dimensions of the human nervous system and permit it to incorporate artificial or self-generated stimuli, which we call signs. Beringians would have most likely spoken a Proto-Indo-Eurasian language. Anyone venturing across the Laurentide and Cordilleran ice sheets would have quickly developed words for crevasse or ice heave or nunatak, signs on the way ahead. When the storm broke, at the end of the second day, a curtain was drawn back. The massive breadth of the ice field came suddenly into view. Dopamine receptors stood on end as clouds unfastened from each other, the silken expanse open, showing not a track or blemish. Q and Stevenson sat in the kitchen trench we dug. Gilman stood next to a cluster of skis planted near the tents. McInerney unzipped his tent door and looked out, seeing rags of sunshot clouds speeding below a topaz sky. As the hole widened, nunataks began to appear, summits in the distance coming out of nothing. Our eyes weren't sure what to do with it all. The world seemed to quaver. Q let out a whoop, but Gilman folded her arms and squared her jaw at the rest of us. She asked, "What if that's a sucker hole?" Taller than any man on this trip, she was immovable. When she had said earlier she wanted for all of us to practice self-rescue knots, McInerney had grumbled under his breath, "Chances are if anyone falls through a crevasse, they're just fucked. They're not coming out alive, even if we are roped up." She'd been expressing concern over the past day and a half. Not enough attention was given to safety plans, not enough time scouting and surveying what could certainly be a dangerous approach. Every trip needs someone to be saying, "Do we know what we're doing?" "I am uncomfortable leaving right now," Gilman said, pointing out that it was after 7 o'clock and we had only a few hours of good daylight left. If the hole closed back in, she wanted to be at this camp, not strung out somewhere on the ice. Q, our other strongest member, a short but burly figure who could carry any one of us out of here over his shoulder, called bullshit. He, more than anyone, wanted to get out there. Nunataks were waiting, and he wanted to see Stevenson climb one. Q said that if we stayed, food would run out. Fuel would be used up for melting snow. We'd be sitting on our asses, our trip basically over, and we'd have gotten nowhere. On any good journey, you'd need both, a Q and a Gilman. One pushes the trek to go on against the odds, and the other makes sure you don't die. "Let's give it an hour," said Stevenson, another needed voice, a good leader to smooth it all out and make the call. He said, "We can have some food, fuel ourselves up. If the window's still open, we go." In an hour, the hole in the storm was wider, a hallway of nunataks revealed across the blank face of the Harding. Q and Gilman, like a pair of siblings, were done with their feud and had gone back to chest bumping. We took camp down and moved gear into sleds and backpacks, clicking into our ski bindings to get as much distance as possible before the day ended. We set a line across the expanse, clean wind racing around us. Q broke out front, a raw shot of energy on the ice field, sled hissing behind him as he parted from the rest of us, as if forgetting he'd come with anyone. He lifted a pole in the air and let out a Viking holler. Nunataks littered ahead like asteroids. At a sunrise camp on the ice field, our tents were frosted like two colorful eggs. We'd established ourselves in a miles-wide hall of summits, a statuary of ragged nunataks. Dark surfaces of metamorphic bedrock were melting through, the mountains mostly white with snow. We left camp for the day, skiing into snowy rises. At the first ridge, Gilman and McInerney decided to hang back. Gilman didn't like the cavernous threat of bergschrunds, the deep crevasses that form where glaciers pull away from the mountains. She said she'd rather be sketching. McInerney smiled and waved, saying he had enough adventure and did not need to go up one of these nunataks. That left Q, Stevenson, and me to summit. We contoured on skis into a group of rugged peaks standing around each other like a coven. The simplest peak was our aim, a pyramid with rock heap summit broken up through snow cornices, one final piece of land the glaciers hadn't been able to eat. In a stadium-sized bowl on its flank, fumbling with gloves to tighten one of his ski bindings, Q unclipped his ski from its leash and it slipped out of his grip. He dove, planting the side of his face in the snow, arms thrown out. He missed the ski by inches. It flew. Without a word, Stevenson drove a pole and turned down slope, slicing after the solo ski. Stevenson had told me there's only one mountaineering rule you really need to know. Don't fuck up. Small mistakes add up out here. As Stevenson and the ski lost elevation, the scope of this place began to resolve. The mountain became bigger, the sweep of snow rising and falling between other mountains onto the face of the Harding, which grew by every 100 feet of descent. Q cursed as he got back up, watching Stevenson and the ski become smaller. Later, Stevenson said it was one of the best runs of his life. The ski followed a perfect line, path of least resistance. He stayed on it at top speed like a shadow. When it planed out a mile below onto the ice field, pursuer and pursued finally stopped, and we could see where we were, the scale of the earth revealed. We'd lost an hour. Stevenson was exhilarated, beaming, when Q went down after him, hobbling on one ski to catch up with his other. Saying little, our lips chunky with sunscreen and flakes of sun-cooked skin, we ditched our skis when we reached the place where snow on ice turned back into snow on rock. The summit was a few 100 feet above us. Hand over hand, we climbed in stubborn, hard boots up a steep angle of repose, staying out of each other's lines, avoiding rockfall and crystalline cascades of corn snow. Crab-shaped squalls flustered around us, taking other summits and giving them back. The ice sheet below was a lake of cloud shadows, our camp so far out it hurt the eyes to try and find it, like looking for a hawk circling so high it disappears. As we reached a swayback saddle buried in snow near the top, Stevenson and I turned for the summit. Q went the other way to set up the tripod he'd been carrying. He wanted to film Stevenson's triumphal arrival atop his first nunatak. The two of us scrambled up a shattered blocky summit, the top barely large enough to stand on with two boots. Stevenson went first. He secured both hard soles as he rose up, lifting his arms, top of the world, king of the hill. Did the first people summit so triumphantly? Attaining such a height would have been like unrolling a map, seeing where you are. Birds may have told of a continent ahead, but every horizon offered many choices and turns in direction. Who knew how much ice was between here and the other side? At least Scott and Amundsen knew there was a South Pole and how far away it was, what provisions were needed, what did Ice Age travelers see? I see a chain of stepping stones across the ice, one viewpoint to the next. This nunatak route would have descended the Cordilleran ice sheet, peaks of the Rockies and the coastal ranges sticking up along the continent's western margin. Scraping lichens off the rock and eating birds, a scouting party might have made it a couple thousand miles, discovering an uninhabited continent on the other side. As we came down from the summit, I sank in snow, working my way onto the bulb of a cornice, a good vantage across the ice field. Every step was a post hole, breaking to my knees. Crevasses opened in the chasms hundreds of feet below. Beyond those, I could see the tips of other nearby mountains. Farther out, 20 miles away, a cluster of nunataks gathered like an island before the ice field dipped over the horizon, line of sight gone. Near the edge of the cornice, I found fresh bird tracks. Where the bird had landed, wing prints touched snow. It had come from the same direction as us. Perhaps flying the same route that brought the bear, the same green valley and river behind us where we'd started. It had landed and walked across the cornice to look down the other side, exactly as I was doing. We think of ourselves as different from other animals. We extol our own tool use, congratulate our sentience, but our needs are the same. We are creatures on a planet looking for a way ahead. Why do we like vistas? Why are pullouts drawn on the sides of highways? Signs with arrows showing where to stand for the best view? The love for the panorama comes from memory, the earliest form of cartography, a sense of location. Little feels better than knowing where you are and having a reason to be there. The bird was a raven, its toe prints armored and tucked together so it wouldn't sink as it walked. It had lost a dime-sized feather, black around the tip, white at the quill. The feather had melted slightly into the snow, leaving an X on the map. At the round tip of the cornice, the raven had opened its wings again, continuing in the same direction. It might have stopped here for a breather, a chance to rest. Where the last tracks ended and the raven flew off, I could see its black wings spreading. The land took shape as it launched over the ice sheet, the bird becoming smaller, the mountains and ice growing. My mind's eye watched its path continue, a perfect line, a direction of travel that passed through me like an arrow. A light wind coursed across the ice field that evening. Galaxies of snow squalls drifted left to right. The Nunatak we'd climbed earlier stood miles away, appearing and disappearing through clouds. As stoves melted snow, we heard a distant drone. It was an engine, two engines, their pitches vibrating against each other. Gathered around a kitchen trench, we peered through low golden light. Two planes cruised the horizon. They had the high-pitched drone of Super Cubs, small single-engine monoplanes, room in the cockpit for a pilot and a moose dressed out from a hunt. A couple hundred feet off the deck, the planes swung between squalls like gliding birds. I stood from my spot in the trench, Gilman stood from hers, and Q began unbuckling his camera. Stevenson and McInerney remained seated, whiskey in their cups. One plane was on the other's tail and just slightly to the side. The formation was a way of communication, two animals crossing the ice, one looking past the other's shoulder. They must have been out for the golden light of sunset, taking in the amazing breadth of white. When they spotted us, they turned in tandem. How could they not? Like seeks like. The sound of their approach grew into a clamor. Stevenson stood, cup in hand. The two planes dropped just above the deck. At 50 or 60 miles per hour, they did in a few minutes what had taken us 6 days. This was evolution. We could see a pilot in each window, wings tipping hello as they skimmed past. I launched a fist of solidarity. Gilman reared back with a wild howl. Q tracked them with his camera as if they were UFOs. Stevenson and McInerney turned to watch them go. We were the same tribe, a species feeling its edges, remembering what it's like to see the world unknown. Same as the couple who'd followed our posthole tracks 3,000 feet up from the valley floor, we were drawn to immensity. Something beyond us calls. The sound of 150 horsepower engines buzzed into the distance and faded. Stevenson sat back down, boots in the trench. We need each other. One of the reasons for migration is the bond of society, an urge to be together. A group might keep going for no other reason than the hope to find others. Seeing planes out here was a curious relief. They were like us. After the elders went to their tents, snuggling up with their paperbacks, the three of us were left outside staring into the blue drift of evening storms. The Super Cubs had left a delicious wake of emptiness. It felt as if the planes had unzipped the sky, the world even larger than we knew. I carried in my gear a small amount of red ochre. I'd been traveling with this plug of mineral in a plastic bag in a zippered compartment for nearly 20 years. Ernst Reschner, a paleoanthropologist at the University of Haifa in Israel, wrote, "Prehistory has produced evidence for two meaningful regularities in human evolution, toolmaking and the collection and use of ochre." Over time, my ochre had decreased, pulled out and used for special occasions every several years. I told Q and Sarah that I had some in my pack, and this was just the night, a celebration of an excellent day, a Nunatak climbed, Super Cubs for fireworks to close it out. Digging into the top zipper through pens, twine, knives, bandages, and toiletries, I found the thumb-sized package, a plastic bag twisted around itself and cinched with a rubber band. The red of the ochre was leaking out of the bag, lightly polishing everything in the compartment with a ruby blush on my pens and headlamp. We asked Stevenson and McInerney if they wanted to partake. A book page turned inside the tent, and McInerney said, "You kids go right ahead." When I'd first collected the ochre, I hadn't known what it was, not technically. It was just a shiny red sediment that rubbed onto the skin like paint. I liked it, so I took some, needling it out with a knife tip from a layer of bright angel shale in the Grand Canyon. It went almost everywhere with me. This spectral blood-red mineral, also known as hematite or iron oxide, is the ceremonial stone of our species. Its use dates back to the beginning of Homo sapiens, found in rituals, human burials, and the earliest art from Africa, Indonesia, and the Iberian Peninsula. A Russian archaeologist who excavated a 36,000-year-old grave in Siberia found the pit drenched in red ochre, what he described as bright as fire and as scarlet as blood. This is perhaps the most telling artifact to come over with the first people. The use of red ochre in Ice Age America is considered to be a sign of direct relationship with Old World Upper Paleolithic complexes. The mineral is utilitarian. Added to pine mastic, it would have helped attach stone tools to their wooden handles. It has preservative properties for skins and hides and is known to heal wounds. It can be used to tan animal hides and keep off rot, and it maintains the skin of corpses. One archaeologist suggested that its use may indicate a continuation of efforts to save the person's life. It also can be painted on skin in a decorative fashion. That's why I picked it out of the rock formation. I knew nothing about ochre's archaeological history at the time. I just liked the pigment that it made. Gilman put out her hand and I crushed a few pinches into her palm. She mixed the powder with water, dipped her fingers, and swept the color along her cheekbones, up her chin, and down her smile lines. She held the most serious expression, her markings standing out against a backdrop of ice and barren, snowbound mountains. She took another swipe from her palm and painted my own wind-dried face with a two-finger streak under each eye and three down my forehead. She turned to Q and gave him a set of war stripes, which he took still-faced, as if anointed. Arizona ochre dried and pulled on our skin. Gilman spread the remaining pigment in her palm and painted out to the tips of her fingers. When her hand was entirely red, she reached down and planted it firmly in the snow. When she lifted her hand away, she left a five-fingered blood mark on the face of the ice field. Chapter 4. The Long Coast. 17,000 years ago. The inside of the boat looked like bones, as if we were standing in the rib cage of an animal. Turned upside down and raised on blocks, this umiak, the traditional skin boat of indigenous northern sea hunters, was made of walrus skin stitched together around a wood frame, eyelets cut through the inch-thick hide and secured with rope. My mom and I took shelter underneath it on St. Lawrence Island in the Bering Sea. We were returning from a stormy hike along the coast, sleet leaking into the seams of our coats. We hid from the wind and blowing sea waves behind a stack of cargo containers. Then we hurried to the shelter of several umiat, plural for umiak, turned upside down on blocks and wooden stilts at the edge of the village. We stood up in the protection of one of these boats, pulling back our hoods, and found ourselves inside an animal. Kayaks and umiat are thought of as living creatures among northern cultures. You have to treat them with respect, as you would anything alive, especially anything larger than you. My mom reached up and touched the boat's keel above our heads. Her fingers traced the wood. She was a furniture builder who worked alone in her shop, spending days and nights with wood falling asleep with sawdust in her hair. She questioned the umiak with her hands. The keel, she pointed out, wasn't cut with a saw, but split out of a larger piece of wood using wedges and pries. The process is called riving, taking the strongest piece out of a tree. Where the tree came from on this barren island, we didn't know. It was prized. Hammered wooden pegs were used instead of nails or screws. She felt along the frame over her head, her hands bony from years of woodworking, a couple fingers cut down to the first knuckle from a table saw. She thought of the hands that made this boat, seeing them grip each rib, bending it into shape, lashing walrus hide to wooden thwarts. The boat wasn't a piece of furniture to her, not like a table or bench that she might build. It looked more like a basket with ribs and cross ribs secured by fine, strong twine. The wood and hide boat is a universal way of getting around on the water. Like the coracles of early Britain, ox hides stretched around large wooden baskets. According to medieval accounts, the 6th-century Irish monk St. Brendan traveled to the east coast of North America and back in a curragh, a long early Irish boat, wood-framed with skins and a sail. The umiak is another version of the skin boat. Its roots reach into the early Holocene, and probably long before. People in the Ice Age knew about boat travel. Artifacts from 48,000 to 30,000 years old have been found on islands far offshore along the Asian side of the Pacific Rim. The only way anyone could have reached these sites was by boat. Boats similar to the umiak, but made of grass or skins, were likely used, as if the people built sea animals for themselves and then climbed inside. To the Inuit of Greenland, the umiak is known as the woman's boat, originally paddled by women, while men used skin kayaks, sometimes aided by sails. A kayak is closed, but an umiak is open and can carry about 10 people. It's the family boat. Turned over, they were used as shelters, arranged in a circle or a crescent, to form a kind of village. Groups traveled together, kayaks and umiak moving from camp to camp. They followed hunting patterns and bird migrations, collecting eggs, seaweed, and driftwood, hunting caribou, salmon, seal, and whale. This was before permanent villages, an older way of living, people born into motion. We'd heard stories of skin boats with families or hunters who went down in foul weather off the coast of St. Lawrence Island. Shores were marked with white wooden crosses, places where people had perished. When people described these disasters, how the waves swamped one skin boat after another, I pictured bodies sinking like angels, sealskins and coats waving their arms as they descended into the Bering Sea. When I was a kid, our umiak was a Volkswagen Bug, a round shell of a car painted baby blue, plying the dry spaces of Arizona and Colorado. Our family was tight, a single mom and her only child. We moved frequently, sailing across the Southwest like mariners. We would not have survived in the Paleolithic, the two of us alone. We'd have been eaten by saber-tooths before we knew it. A family of only two would have meant something had gone terribly wrong, a vulnerable configuration. The last time I saw that car, I was 4 years old. I was asleep one morning in the back seat near Nutriosa, Arizona. Maybe my mom nodded off at the wheel, or sunrise momentarily blinded her through the bug guts on the windshield. A tire caught the edge of the asphalt, and we flipped. The Volkswagen crashed through a wood pole fence and rolled a few times into a field. My mom's big white Samsonite suitcase went flying. I remember how it seemed to pause for a moment in midair just before it landed and pummeled me, and I pummeled it back. Our baby blue umiak came to rest on its roof. My mom and I were fine, no breaks or blood or twisted metal. I remember the pecan pie. It fell out of the upside-down vehicle onto the dry, pine-needled ground, and a dog came up and ate it. We caught a ride into town in a postal truck. Rain had just started to fall. The Arizona highlands smelled cool and crisp with pines as windshield wipers pushed rainwater back and forth. This is from my own origin story. It is how I know who I am. Going ahead without stories or family is like falling off the edge of the earth. When my mom and I sheltered under the umiak on an island in the Bering Sea, it was another tale added to the stack, a trail of breadcrumbs marking my passage into the new world. In Native tales from the Northwest, Raven, the trickster god, is said to have been walking along the beach one day when he found the first people inside a sealed clamshell washed up from who knows where. He paused, lowering his glistening black head to listen. He heard movement inside, a kind of bumping, like elbows and knees knocking against each other. Curious, he pried the shell open with his beak. From the dark hold emerged the first people, naked and excited. Raven stepped back as they scampered away, the prints of their grape-sized toes heading off in all directions. The world would never be the same. Who knows how many firsts there were, how many clamshells landed on this side of the world. The Fukushima earthquake hit the coast of Japan on April 11, 2011. The following tsunami washed nearly 5 million tons of debris, including boats, cars, parts of houses and factories, and some of the 20,000 dead into the Pacific. Debris entered the gyratory Kuroshio current and swept toward North America, where objects began to arrive a month later. The first landing was April 18, when a cargo box from Yamamoto in Miyagi Prefecture, the hardest hit from the quake, washed onto a heavily forested island of Haida Gwaii on the west coast of British Columbia. The box opened as it hit the beach, and a Harley-Davidson motorcycle rolled onto the sand. This was the first offering from Japan. The coast of Haida Gwaii is the same place where the original clamshell is said to have washed ashore. Tens of thousands of years ago, it was a clamshell, and now it is a Harley-Davidson, taking a month under no power but wind and sea to make the 4,000 miles from Japan to the edge of North America. Tend to a boat of thick sea cow skins blown off course, they would have eventually given up trying to paddle home, letting the sea take them. Their drinking water would have been rain or maybe captured pieces of icebergs. They ate what they could spear or hook. Perhaps they prayed to an Ice Age iteration of Okikurum, the creator god of the prehistoric Ainu, descendants of the seafaring Jomon who hunted waters of the North Asian Pacific Rim for more than 10,000 years. The only solace may have been a whale spout. Seeing one and then another, they may have begun to paddle in the direction of the whales, a spring migration to distant kelp forests. A bird would have been spotted, then another. Seals would have lifted their heads from the water. Land would have appeared. The first footsteps onto North America may have been people jumping into the water, dragging their skin boat onto unfamiliar shores. Seeing an enormous ice cap rising above a ragged coast, they would have all asked the same question. Where are we? You would have needed families, not just a lost few. Without grandparents and children, it's not a migration. It's just a lark, as Gilman put it. People doing shit. With my own family, my two kids and my wife, our clamshell landed where glaciers and mountains fall into the waters of Prince William Sound, south central Alaska. It was late June. Earlier that month, I'd been on the Harding Ice Field. Switching out of skis, boots, and sleds, I was now setting off for a 1,200-mile journey south from Prince William Sound by kayak, plane, and ferry to the upper corner of Washington, where the first ice-free interior would have opened for Ice Age boat travelers. The ice and our Nunatak route had been exhilarating, but it was no way to move a family. 20,000 years ago, this coast was nothing. Where the expanding Cordilleran ice sheet came to the water, half-mile-high towers of ice plunged into the sea. Places to land were hard to find. Most of the shoreline was covered in glaciers. But by 17,000 years ago, a coastline began to appear. The coldest times were over, the last glacial maximum done. The first land exposed by warming temperatures and the retreat of the North American ice cap was not inland, but here. The northwest coast became a cheat, a way to get around the ice. Archaeologist Knut Fladmark proposed in 1979 that a coastal route, not the ice-free land bridge, brought the first people to America. In an American Antiquity article titled Alternate Migration Corridors for Early Man in North America, he wrote about the islands and coasts that might have existed then. He noted, these would have been more environmentally suitable for human occupation than any interior ice-free areas, and marine littoral resources would have provided a relatively abundant living for any people possessing simple watercraft. Biologists in the 1960s had found evidence of plant life on the Ice Age margins of Alaska and British Columbia, a region previously thought to have been ice-scoured and devoid of life. Bare bones from the last glacial maximum were discovered in caves in British Columbia, indicating that isolated populations of large animals survived. There had been refuges, places to land the whole time, a perfect way into North America if you had a boat. If plants and bears could live, Fladmark concluded, then there could have been people. In 1997, archaeologists and marine ecologists presented the kelp highway hypothesis. The coast, they said, had actually been highly productive during the Ice Age. Kelp is a large seaweed in the order Laminarialis that grows in towering columns anchored to the sea floor, suspended by gas-filled bladders. Waving through the water, it creates its own ecosystem, from isopods to otters and orcas, one that continues up the rivers and onto land where brown bears fish for salmon and scavenge seal and walrus carcasses. Citing glacial retreat and pollen, the report concluded, By about 16,000 years ago, the North Pacific coast offered a linear migration route, essentially unobstructed and entirely at sea level, from Northeast Asia into the Americas. Sites along the coast from deep in the Ice Age would be underwater now, and mostly lost. Still, people could have been there. The textbook picture of bold mammoth hunters chasing game across a land bridge and through or over the ice is changing. Now it looks like skin boat travelers. Ultimately, people would have crossed the land bridge anyway and probably attempted the ice sheets, hopping along nunataks and ice-free corridors. Yet the coast remains the most viable route into Ice Age America. Paddling past coves and gray bedrock shoals, we were a fleet of six tandem kayaks, brightly colored, glowing under a low gray sky. We'd been dropped out here by a boat 3 hours out of Whittier, Alaska. I paused and set my paddle across the deck. My older son and I sat in spray skirts in the two cockpits of my double-seater. He was 10, my youngest 6, paddled diligently in his mother's boat a few hundred yards out from us. Others were within shouting distance. We had 5 children altogether, ages 4 to almost 12, and 7 adults, most of us parents, and 1 younger, childless couple. This was our tribe. I had wanted to get closer to the ice, better representing the late Pleistocene, but the moms said no. I said we could camp several miles west of here where glaciers calve directly into the water. The air temperature was almost 20 degrees colder from its proximity to ice. It was frigid and epic. We would have to bundle up, but it was worthwhile, I argued. We'd be kayaking among half-stable ice masses and bobbing bergy bits. But the moms decided on a constellation of islands sheltered behind a bigger island with glaciers, protected from weather coming in off the gulf. The only ice was the occasional stranded berg or a swan-shaped ice sculpture drifting by. The late poet and orca scientist Eva Salidis liked to shelter her research vessel here during storms. She'd later tell me that we picked one of the most placid parts of the entire sound, a cove that she called the Sanctuary. The moms must have known this somehow. Salidis told me that on a quiet night, she heard the sounds of children and adults, voices and movement, even though she knew no one was there. Later she learned that the cove had been used by Tlingit families during big hunts. She believed she'd been hearing ghosts. Instead of paddling, my older boy skimmed the water with the blade of his paddle. That's a thing with 10-year-olds. Getting them to paddle can be difficult. If he were a Paleolithic kid, I thought he'd get smacked upside the head. But I was a 21st century dad. I wondered what my son imagined in the shadows below. A humpback whale spouted several hundred feet to our left. "Jasper," I said, "Jasper." He looked up and rested his paddle on the deck as the whale's back crested slick and blue, then tipped down into its dive, the spray from its blow landing across the water like rain. The boy didn't say anything, his eyes taking it in, brain folding this away into memory. He'd seen whales before, but never so close. When the fluke lifted and slipped under, he tipped his paddle to the water and returned to his ripples. Imagine the shock for a Beringian from Siberia, roaming south to the landbridge coast and seeing an animal 6 times the heft of a woolly mammoth rise from the water with a misty exhale. Amazed parents must have pointed then, too. In a Proto-American Indo-Eurasian language, they would have told their children, "Look, look," whether the child was looking or not. A second whale spouted closer. Spray went 40 feet into the air and curled into mist. We heard a great windy inhalation as it turned into its dive. The slick green obsidian spine slid into the water, last to go where the flukes flipping upward, casting off a cascade of seawater before slipping under. On land, the kids never went anywhere alone, not even to pee back in the thickets of alder and spruce. Always in pairs, they wore whistles around their necks. There were bears. Scouting a nearby island for camp, we found a fresh kill in a maze of grizzly tracks. A fawn about the size of the youngest in our group, its bones splintered and head twisted backwards, eyes glassy. The bear had covered up the carcass with a light scraping of sticks and leaves. We had a single sidearm, a .357 handgun, not the most effective for laying down a bear. It was for noise mostly, warning shots if necessary. We left kayaks at camp one day and walked into the interior of our island, lunches and day packs, kids ringing bells and clapping, adults with bear spray, air horns. We climbed to a high point, pushing kids ahead, helping them over fallen trees, steering around spiny raspberry vines. We cleared the top with a view of surrounding islands and the white cap of an ice field pouring down through peaks, touching water. That night, quiet fell over camp. The long day's ruckus calmed, water in the cove was still and dark, the rocky shoreline hugged by alders and shaggy black spruce. The last light went out in the last tent on a small island across from the kitchen. Stories were told, cheeks kissed. In the twilight of a southern Alaskan summer, the rest of us stayed up tidying. As if going through the house after bedtime, we put away toothbrushes and damp socks. But we weren't in a house. Any food not in hard plastic bear boxes was packed into bags that we hung up as high and intricately as we could away from the bears. Becky Ela, one of the moms, sat on a gearbox, whittling a stick with a buck knife, enjoying the evening's peace. She said, "I love having a small contained existence in the wild. I lie in the tent at night with my family all around and I think, I love this." She smiled at me and said, "No offense, but probably more than you do." Gender had been an issue from day one, our tasks divided by male and female. This was never discussed, it just happened. "We're all working, and it's equal to keeping things going, but different," Becky said. She took a breath, slivered off another curl, and told me the women did the meal planning and most of the cooking, while the men built fires, caught fish, etc. Rain began to fall in the dusk light as she curled back wood with her knife blade. She told me that she and my wife, the two mothers, knew where all the kids were at any moment, and knew what they were doing, who was cold, who had spilled hot chocolate all over their pants, who couldn't find their socks. It didn't matter whose kids they were. "I think that's a pretty gender-identified awareness," she said. She seemed content sitting with a friend out of the rain on a wilderness island. Our roles, the weather, didn't seem to trouble her. "I think if we stayed here longer, our gender roles would evolve," Becky said. "We've got three strong, competent women who are probably just as happy fishing and paddling and lighting fires as, say, boiling tasty bites. Given the duration of our stay, I believe that we've just settled into roles which we know and others have come to expect. Perhaps not what we would choose, but what we fall into." "You think we were the same in the Ice Age?" I asked. Another flick of wood. "Yes." Nicole Wagaspak, a paleoarchaeologist at the University of Wyoming, sees women's work in the Ice Age as invisible, at least as far as artifacts are concerned. Women likely used organic raw materials, plant products, leather, and sinew, things that don't survive many thousands of years. Archaeologists look for stone, bone, antler, and wood, stereotypically male items. Wagaspak calls the phenomena the incredible shrinking prehistoric woman. She writes, "Equating women solely with plant gathering is reducing their role in prehistoric societies to activities for which they may have spent little time and effort." The shrinking phenomenon may not be entirely the effect of preservational bias, but the inherent bias of archaeologists limiting female labor to the plant realm. Women could have been out killing mammoths while men cradled children. The assumption that it must have happened the other way is largely a feature of modern patriarchal thinking. When I told Becky about the incredible shrinking Paleolithic woman and noted that women are believed to leave only artifacts that vanish, she laughed. "We don't leave artifacts? Come on. We leave the only real artifact there is." When sea levels dropped, it was time to move. The world was suddenly open, islands and continents connected by land bridges. Asia and North America formed a single unbroken coastline, 22,000 miles long from Sumatra around the northern horseshoe of the Pacific Rim, connected by the land bridge and down to the bottom of South America. The Bering Land Bridge was the linchpin, and though you might first think of its grassy, mammoth-studded interior, it had a coast as well. This is the most likely way people arrived in enough numbers to make an archaeological dent in America. Evidence of boat use along the Asian coast goes back at least 48,000 years, when humans reached Australia. That would have required open-ocean crossings capable of carrying families, enough to form a genetic founding population. Late Pleistocene shell middens on the island of New Ireland, off the coast of New Guinea, are 40,000 years old. So are the stone artifacts on the nearby Solomon Islands. Too far to swim means boats. Obsidian artifacts 35,000 years old have been found on Kazushima Island off eastern Honshu in Japan, while a 35,000-year-old human skeleton was found on Okinawa off the coast of Taiwan, another stretch no one could have swum. Farther north, people may have switched from straw and wood boats to skin and wood, encountering Bergman's rule, the colder, the larger. Their umiat would have appeared in the Kuril Islands on the eastern edge of Russia. I spoke with Zhenya Anachenko, a coastal prehistoric boat archaeologist born in Russia and recently moved to the U.S. Anachenko, currently a researcher at the Anchorage Museum, had identified wooden pieces of a 1,000-year-old umiak, the oldest boat remains preserved in the circumpolar north. When we talked, she was living and working in Alaska. Anachenko asked if I'd ever lived anywhere completely unfamiliar, actually lived there, not just visited, but put down new roots. I said no, I was a homebody. Though I'd traveled extensively, I'd lived only in Colorado, Arizona, and New Mexico, each state pressed against the other. This constitutes tethered nomadism, ranging far but always coming home. Anachenko, on the other hand, had joined the ranks of true nomads, people who never return. She'd go back, of course, and visit places and loved ones in Russia, but she'd never live there again. She'd jumped continents. She said I should try it sometime, that it would greatly improve my understanding of how humans leave home. What a deep-seated challenge it is to keep going across the globe. Holding me fast in her blue-eyed gaze, Anachenko said, immigration is a disease. Anachenko said I would never find the boats I was looking for. She doubts that perishable materials such as skin and wood could last 10,000 years or more. With sea levels 400 feet higher than their Ice Age low stand, most coastal sites are inundated. The First People's Trail along the Asian Rim is marked by other artifacts, not boats. Core and blade technology, bifacial points, and stone scrapers from the late Pleistocene came up in the Kuril Islands to Kamchatka. From there, it was 2,000 miles of coast and island hopping before landfall in Alaska, where Diane Hansen has been waiting for the First People with her excavation crews in the Aleutians, a catcher's mitt ready for their arrival. But how many came, and would they even be visible? Genomic modeling suggests a founding American population of 500 people, barely enough to take hold. So few people would easily slip through a scientist's fingers. John Turk kayaked 3,000 miles from the Kuril Islands to St. Lawrence Island in the Bering Strait. He took 6 months in a series of legs exploring shorelines, hugging coves, and returning to useful campsites. Turk is a chemistry PhD turned science writer and hardscrabble adventurer, now writing books on long-distance exploration, crossing landscapes of ice and water few would ever consider. He started this journey in a trimaran and switched to a kayak to make the rougher crossing to St. Lawrence Island. The route, he believes, follows the travels of an early people known as the Jomon, an ancient Japanese culture going back at least to the end of the Ice Age. Some of their artifacts can be found in the Metropolitan Museum of Art, elegant ivory needles, hooks, and harpoons. They may have been descendants of those who first paddled to the Americas. Turk thinks the earliest Jomon must have known of this side of the world and traveled here frequently, their transient encampments now hidden under hundreds of feet of water, the Ice Age nearly forgotten. Traveling such distances as an adventurer is one thing. Doing it with families is a wholly different proposition. Day 5, we were running low on food. The moms were the first to notice. Dads did the food buy in Anchorage, and we'd gone light on snacks, which cut into the staple supplies. We were eating rehydrated hummus and cheese too fast. If we were real Alaskans, we'd be eating salmon, but we didn't know these waters. We dropped a crab pot, checking it a few times a day, mostly catching starfish. Over the next few days, we had to ration and dig deeper into wild foods. Steamed clams for breakfast, ling cod caught on a line and sizzled in a pan for dinner. We had a biologist on the trip, Irvin Fernandez, who specializes in eating from the land in unfamiliar places, spiders in Cameroon and tree beetle grubs in Central America. He was just the man a tribe like ours needed. I'd traveled with Irvin for decades, eating bugs and seeds in the desert with him. We killed a jackrabbit in Arizona with a slingshot, gutted, skinned, cooked it on a Palo Verde fire. Traveling the Mexican coast of Sonora by foot, we ate almost every living thing we could find along those parched desert beaches, emptying slugs and silver dollar crabs onto a tarp to decide what was viable and what wasn't. Irvin had an admirable way of experimenting with his mouth, taking in unfamiliar foods, usually faunal, and chewing them to pieces with a quizzical expression on his face, asking questions of every taste and texture. He believes it is a coastal way of eating, something that comes naturally to families of the Pacific Rim. It is also something you learn while foraging in unfamiliar foodscapes. What he didn't want, he spat out. Shells, bones, exoskeletons, acidic excretory sacs, the head caps of grubs. The kids watched, captivated. It was like science class, studying antenna sprouts and knobby eyeballs of prawns we caught in the pot, as Irvin showed them how to eat heads whole. He said yes to one thing, no to another. Yes to the many mollusks we dug up in our low-tide climbing industry. No to a twisting 2-foot-long annelid worm that a farm kid from western Colorado wanted to put down his sister's shirt. The younger kids, including Irvin's 4-year-old son, proffered seaweed to the group, collecting different species based on the biologist's instructions. They toasted Palmaria hackatensis, a red-ribbon seaweed with olive oil and salt. They called it sea bacon to entice us. We ate until we couldn't take any more. I believe that's why coastal travel would have always been preferable to the interior. Free food. Use of marine resources was common in the Ice Age. Isotopic measurements of bone collagen from 12,000-year-old human remains in a cave in North Wales, United Kingdom, indicate that 30% of their dietary protein came from marine sources. Technically, Ice Age people weren't hunters or gatherers. They were like us in our kayaks, foragers, searching widely for food and provisions. In the interior, it was eat or be eaten, while here there was food in the water and on land. It was hard to go hungry. You could dig in the wet tidal zone for mollusks, gather seaweed, fish, prawns, berries, deer, moose. At Ice Age coastal sites in California, Peru, and Chile, people ate mastodon, salmon, seaweed, deer, and sea lion. They weren't maritime specialists, unlike most coastal dwellers from the last several thousand years. They inhaled the coast as they went, whatever land or sea offered. Every degree down the face of the globe brought something new. Children, we discovered, were a great bear deterrent. Adults scouting other islands found fresh bear sign all over the place, tracks and scat everywhere. With kids, however, our camp felt off limits, the closest fresh bear scat about half a mile inland. Once we took over a cove, with tarps and squealing, running little monsters, the bears cleared out. I pictured them huddled at the opposite end of the island, waiting for all the yelling and stomping to cease. I studied each of our children, wondering who they'd be in a tribe on the far side of the world. Any tribe would need hunters and healers, people who knew the plants, what was edible and what wasn't, the bark of mountain alder good for arthritis, the willow for headaches. How to eat and how not to get eaten. Someone would have had to have an eye for sickly mammoths in the hunt. Another would need to be good at starting fires with a hand drill, catching kindling under a crisscross of greasy megafauna bones on a wild Pleistocene coast. What would my own boys have done in this ancient tribe? They stuck their noses into bear prints, ate leaves, and held up driftwood, aligning themselves with horizons. In a half-hearted rain, my younger boy, Jado, was down by the water talking to animals. 6 years old, he stood at the edge of the tide in black rubber boots, holding a barnacle-encrusted rock. He cupped it near his mouth in both hands and hummed to it. I approached the boy like a modern father. I flipped on my camera and asked what he was doing. Jado looked up, distracted, dots of mist caught in his eyelashes. Glancing at the camera, he said, "I'm humming to make them come out." "To make what come out?" "The snails." He tipped the rock toward me, showing a couple small black periwinkles. "So you hum and the snails come out of their shells?" "Yeah, but it takes an hour to get them to come out." He turned and scurried away. He who talks to snails. You would have needed one of these in the Ice Age, at the edge of the known world. The spirit of an animal can kill you. It is not human. It is not concerned with our enterprises, so we must be concerned with its. When you are pure in wild places, you understand what is not just us, what is beyond our self-admiring sphere. The first people would have hedged every bet. Somebody needed to talk to the animals, calling them in for the hunt, fending off the most fearsome and dangerous with a prayer and offering a word of thanks to land and sea. Whatever it took, shamans were needed. The earliest known shaman comes from 12,000 years ago, well within the brackets of the Ice Age. The remains are from a late Pleistocene excavation in the Galilee region of Israel. A roughly 45-year-old female was buried with 50 complete tortoise shells. The leg of a wild boar, an eagle wing, cow tail, a leopard, two marten skulls, a complete horn core from a male gazelle, and a single human foot. The unusual accompaniment of parts suggests to researchers that she held a position of spiritual import between worlds. In North America, the oldest suggestion of shamanism, not counting the simple presence of ochre, comes from the last few thousand years, ritualized twig figurines of animals in the caves of the Grand Canyon, or wildly pecked and painted canyon walls in Utah and California, people turning into birds and animals, liminal creatures between one world and the next. You see faces coming out of the caves of Jamaica, their rounded features like ghosts, not quite in the light, but not in darkness, as if peeking out at the created world. Shamans are the ones who went into the shadows and did whatever could be done to ensure the survival of the people. You would have needed them to get you through. With its gentle breakwaters and shelters, the Ice Age coast of Alaska would have been a slightly colder version of what is here today. Based on sea floor topography, with sea levels 400 feet lower, the coast along the land bridge was edged with hundreds of small islands. Kelp forests wove through the waters, forming the northernmost stretch of the Kelp Highway, a ribbon of high biotic potential that stretched from Japan to Baja. An unbroken stretch of luxury, an invitation to North America from Asia. Alaskan kelp beds in the Ice Age may have been more productive in the cooler waters, their ecology richer than today. Now extinct sea cows, manatee-like mammals 30 feet long and weighing several tons, would have drifted near the surface. Even with an ice-locked coast, this would have been far easier foraging than the heart of a 5 million square mile ice sheet, or some crumbling, glacier-scoured corridor from Yukon to Montana. In the morning, shucking clams into a bucket, in the rain under a tarp, conversation arose. What if we were the only ones out here? This was the farthest edge of the human species, no one ahead of us, and no one close behind. We'd have to decide who got extra food. The childless man who helped out the parents would have to take precedence, we agreed, his reproductive vigor greater than the rest of the dads. He was a muscular street cop from Denver, and as we talked about this, he shot a nervous glance at his tall girlfriend, a firefighter in training. Neither of them were ready to have a child or even to enter into a conversation like this. The orchard farmer pointed out that he has to schedule tree planting ahead of time to keep his business healthy. He plants 6 years in advance of a harvest, and the same would probably be necessary for our group. At least every 6 years, a new child would have to arrive. My wife, 46-year-old mother of two, looked at the tall girlfriend, childless and 30 years old, and said to her, "I believe you're up." The woman replied, "Why don't we use you up first? You look like you still have another one in you." We were off to a good start. With a generic European blend and a first-generation American-Filipino dad, a half-Korean mom, and a childless African-American man, we had a strong mix, the kind of genetic foundation you'd hope for when starting a new world. Regardless of our ethnic, genetic vitality, we'd be on the path to inbreeding within two generations. Survival rates among newborns fall sharply after direct bloodlines begin mating with each other. Baby girls would be less likely to survive. Female physiology takes more energy to maintain. Males, cheaper to produce, would be sent out like the last sparks, a burst of sperm donors looking for females as we drifted toward extinction. The magic minimal number for human colonization is 160. 12 is far too few. 40 is possible with a strict mating regimen, but it still skirts dangerously close to extinction. A 2014 study in the Journal of the International Academy of Astronautics looked at a 5-year colonization mission into space, estimating that between 14,000 and 40,000 people would be the safest guarantee for long-term survival. Those numbers would maintain good health over 5 generations, enough to last through at least 1 severe population catastrophe before reaching a location where they could spread out. In a group of 12, we'd need to find more people with